Thank you very much. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. Hi, so grateful to be here. I'd like to thank you all for having me. I'd like to thank the committee for asking Julie and I to come here. And it's a very special time for me. I am been married, well, next week it'll be 2 months. So if I just sort of glass over during the talk, kind of understand, okay? I mean, you know, I'm not a young man anymore, and oh my goodness, it's so nice to be here. I just love Atlanta. I got sober in Washington D.C., but lived in North Carolina as I do now, but also lived in Birmingham for a while, and so I used to come over here quite a bit, and I just have a lot of friends over here, and I've already seen some that I hadn't seen in quite a while, and it's just nice to be here. And again, we want to thank you very much for having us here. And since this is an unofficial meeting, I don't think I'm going to say anything. I'll wait till tomorrow till it's official. Mass, how many days? I'm the second child in a family of 11 children. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church we went to. You're going to have to guess. And I was born in the Ohio Valley, and just down the river from Pittsburgh, and very nice mom, very nice dad. 16 years ago, I'd have told them they're the reason I drank, them and the nuns. And the Marine Corps, and the fact that I was short, that one, for years, that was, when I first came here, I used to say I used to be tall and I've been sick, but that's a lie. You know, I look back now, and I see that I was wrong about one or two things. Not many, just a few, as I look back, and I'm looking forward to this weekend, I must tell you. I saw M. I met M's a delight. He's going to be speaking Sunday. I met M and Ann in Amarillo a number of years ago. And M doesn't look any different, and I don't either. Just amazing what this program will do for you. You know. But I was born in this small town in the Ohio Valley, and I think I was a pretty normal kid. Not unlike most other kids, I guess, except for one or two minor details. And one of the main things that made me a little bit different from other people was I was one of those kids. There weren't many of us. There were a few. I've met a few in AA since I've been around. But that I was one of those kids who had something who lived under his bed. I don't know if anybody ever had one of those. There were a lot of them in Ohio. I think Ohio was Ohio was a breeding ground for these things, and a lot of you, they may not have gotten this far south, but I'll explain. You might be up north sometime, and maybe you'll go up to Akron for Founders Day or something, and you'll be laying there, and if you press your ear against the mattress, you'll hear it down there, just sort of moving around a little bit, and if you press real hard, you can hear it, and it's not there when the lights are on. It's only there when it's dark. And what it does is, I don't know how to tell you this, but it waits for you to hang your little legs over the side of the bed, right? And then your history. That's all I can tell you, your history. I knew that's true. Because I was an observant little kid. When the first 5 years or so of my life, I couldn't speak very well. I had a terrible speech impediment. And so I did a lot of listening. I haven't done much of that since I learned to talk. But I did a lot of listening. And I used to listen carefully, and I listened to all the other little kids, and I listened to what they said. And I never met a little kid that this thing had gotten, whoever came back. Yeah, I never heard a kid say, "Yeah, that thing under the bed got me, and I came back." So my assumption was that it got you. It's over. It is over, you know. And And after a while, like, you know, weeks and months, it would really get hungry. And then it used to reach up on both sides of the bed when you were asleep. And if you don't believe that, look at the sheets in the morning. You'll see those marks, you know, where it reached up and jerked you under the bed. And I used to lay there and think about stuff like that. Aside from that, I'm pretty normal kid, I think. And then, you know, there was that day that had to come when you had too much Kool-Aid. And I remember that night. And you know, I'm laying there, and I had a real dilemma on my hands. Either I had to put up with the abuse the next morning because I wet the bed, or I was a goner, you know? And it seems to me that those are the kinds of decisions I always had to make. That's part of like being an alcoholic, you know? We just have more things to think about than other people. You know, I mean, it's really, you know, at the end of my drinking, I was working at Georgetown University Hospital. I directed genetics laboratories, and everybody else is sitting around looking in a microscope, you know? And I was sitting there, that's all they were doing. But I was sitting there looking in a microscope, concentrating on not shaking so I wouldn't blind myself, you know? And they wondered why I wanted to get paid more money. I mean, you know, I mean, other people would just get up and talk. I'd have to get up, talk, and concentrate on not falling over. I mean, we just have more stuff to think about than other people. And it started real early in my life. And I remember, I remember that, well, let me tell you what happened the night of the Kool-Aid. I decided that I didn't have a sponsor then, but I didn't. But you know, I was always one of these either-or people. And that night, I thought of a third alternative. I could wet the bed. I could be grabbed by this thing and never come back as long as I lived. Or I could get up, and I could run and leap as far as I could out into the dark void, which is what I did. And it woke the whole house up. And you know, my father ran up and said, "What on earth is going on here?" You know, and I didn't know how to tell him about the decision that I had to make. You know, I just didn't know how to tell him because it was silly. I don't know what he did about the thing under his bed, you know, but the thing under my bed was silly. And then, you know, one night, my mother was out. I don't know, she was having a baby or going to bingo or doing something, and my father was watching us, and we were sitting around the kitchen table, and I was five, and my brother Denny was four, okay? Denny's a real loser. I'll tell you a little about him. He really is. I mean, you'll see what I mean. This is a sick kid. And he got us all beer. Now, there's rarely beer around our house because my grandparents were alcoholic. And so my parents were real careful about alcohol, but there's some beer in the refrigerator. My father got it out, and he gave one to me and one to Denny, and he had one. I guess he thought it was going to be funny, you know. And he gave us little jelly glasses. You know, remember that kind of had cartoon characters on them? And mine had Superman on it. I don't know if that's significant or not. I know some psychologists who probably think so, but at any rate, we drank our beer. You know, I was fine. I mean, it was okay. You know? But I looked over, and old Denny sliding down out of the chair, and he was rolling around under the table singing things like "Mary Had a Little Lamb" and stuff like that. And my father panicked, and he wrestled him to the ground, and he took his clothes off, and he put these jammies on him, you know, the kind with the feet and the trap door and everything. And he carried him upstairs, and I got my jammies on. I went upstairs, and he put us in bed. He said, "Now, look, please, don't say a word to your mother about this. If you don't tell Mommy, I'll take you to the movies." Well, I'm a nice kid. You know, I'm easy to get along with. And I said, "Okay, Dad," and always trying to please. But Denny wasn't hearing it. He's carrying on and laughing and everything. And you know what he did? It's amazing. I was sitting across or sleeping across the room from him, and he stood up in his little crib, and he urinated on the floor. I'll never forget as long as I live. And I remember laying over there watching this disgusting display, you know? And I remember thinking, I don't know where the words came, but I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And it's just, you know, the saddest thing happened. Denny just never made it. I don't know how to explain this. You know, he's just a weird guy. This is embarrassing, but, you know, he grew up, and he went to one college. You know? He had one major. You know? He graduated in 4 years. You know? Went to one graduate school. Graduated on time. Looked around. I mean, looked at like five or six different jobs. And he only took one. You know? And he's been with that company about 20 years as a vice president now in this large international corporation. And you think, how sad, you know. Here's a guy, when he's 4 years old, he had the world in the palm of his hand, you know? And he just let it go. And you know, it gets worse, you know? He married one woman. 19 years ago. And they're still married. They just celebrated their 19th anniversary or something like that, the 10th of this month. Here's a kid who had the world in the palm of his hands, you know? You know, I never urinated on a bedroom floor till I was 18, 19 years old, you know? You know, at the rate he was going, he could have been an Alcoholics Anonymous when he was 13. You know? I don't know. You know, and then there were the nuns. Remember the nuns. You know, I went up to make amends to this brother of mine. I sober about 6 years, and I had this feeling about these nuns. I got to tell you, and you know, the roller, you know, on the knuckles and everything. And so I go up to make amends to this brother of mine, and we began talking, and he began talking about the nuns, and I always like to talk about the nuns. They're the reason I'm here, And so I said, yeah, how about those nuns? What do you think of the nuns? He said, yeah, isn't that something? He said, those nice old ladies dedicated their whole lives to teaching little ingrates like us. And I said, well, that's one way to look at it. I said, how about the bit with the knuckles, you know, the roller and the knuckles? And he said, yeah, I seem to remember something like that. And I said, you probably don't even remember that when they hit me, they used to use the centimeter side. Yeah. And I couldn't understand how he couldn't remember how cruel they were. And, you know, and I remembered Sister Victoria. I have to tell you about Sister Victoria. Sister Victoria ran the library in the high school I went to. And what a lady. I'm telling you, she used to say all this stupid stuff like every boy is a prince and every girl's a princess. She used to say that, you know. So we laugh at her behind her back, you know, call each other Prince Keith and Princess Mary and all that stuff. And she'd always run around, and she'd do things like talking about the love of God, you know. She'd say dumb stuff like, do you realize that you are a special child of God? Okay. And I spent a lot of time with her because she used to do detention in a library. She had a library rack, you know, a magazine rack, and she used to put me behind it. She told me that it's true that I was a prince, but I was also contagious. And she put me behind this magazine rack, and what I had to do was make rosary beads. Okay? Now, for you heretics, those are things that Catholics use to pray on, and they're made up of called decads, which mean 10, and there are 10 beads in each one of these decads. Okay? So I, of course, made them with 11. And I made thousands of these things. I spent a lot of time with Victoria, and I made thousands. I gotta tell you, there are mutant rosary beads all over the world. And you know, she never caught me. This dumb woman never caught me. So finally, just before I graduated, I had a talk with her, because I didn't want all this brilliance to go by the way. Because 3 years I spent with Sister Victoria making mutant rosary beads. And And I said to her, I said, you know what I've been doing? She said, I sure do, you sly little prince. I said, you do? And she said, yes. She said, you've been making rosary beads with 11 beads in each decade. And she smiled and she said, I know why you're doing that. And I thought, this ought to be good. I don't know why I'm doing it. I just seem to be angry all the time, that's all. And she said, it's because all over the world, the Philippines and India and China, that's where they went communist, all over the world, people are praying extra prayers and God's going to give you all the credit. That's what she's telling me. Dumb old woman. Yeah. You know, and I think back about that, you know, and I think of how very much I was loved. You know, I'd have told you sitting down at the bar some 16 and a half years ago that the reason I was the way I was I grew up in poverty, you see, and you didn't know what that was like because we were poor. And, you know, we didn't have a car. We didn't have a television. All I had was 10 brothers and sisters and loving parents who just were spent every moment of their life for me and my brothers and sisters. But you see, I wasn't loved. My parents live down at Carolina Beach in North Carolina, and I have a little house there, and they're keeping an eye on it for me. They've been keeping an eye on it since 1983. And if you go down there to see them, the same thing would happen. It always happens. You know, my mother would have to hug me and kiss me and tell me she loved me and all that stuff. And then my father would come around at night when you're in bed, and he'd knock on a door, and he'd say, do you have enough blankets? I don't care if it's August. He'd say, do you have enough blankets? And I'd say, yeah, Dad. And then he'd say, did you say your prayers? And I'd say, yeah, Dad. And, you know, here's a guy who every day I'd let him would go to the ball field with me. And if it was too cold to play baseball, we'd go down in the basement and we'd take grounders off the back wall. And he's a machinist, and he built these batting tees and things for us. We had him before the major league did. And this is the kind of guy he was. He was just sort of a quiet guy who always showed up. And he's a spiritual giant. But you see, I couldn't see any of this. And I think that more than anything else, that's the story of my alcoholism. That I was surrounded by love, and all I could see was dirt. I just couldn't see it. You know, I had a mother who never finished high school, but she read about a book a day. And we used to, before I was 16 years old, I had read almost all the classics. We had a reading hour every night. And you weren't allowed to do schoolwork during this hour. This was so you could read to learn something and read to enjoy it. And we would act out plays in the living room because we didn't have a television and all this business. And you know, I look back on all of that, and I didn't see the value of it. So what I know now is, as a child, I was an extremely wealthy young man. But I didn't know it. I didn't know it. And that's alcoholism for me. And when I came here, you told me that what I suffered from was a spiritual illness. I didn't understand what you meant. I didn't understand that a spiritual illness meant I could look at beauty and not see it, and I could hear words of wisdom and not hear them. And that's what I didn't know. You know, I escaped that scene when I was 17 years old. And I looked in the mirror one day. I was 5 feet 1 inches tall. I weighed 113 pounds. I was clearly a born killer. And so I went up to Pittsburgh and joined the Marine Corps. It's the only thing that made sense to me. And aside from the disgusting display of my brother, I'd never had anything to drink. Oh, occasionally we might have a little drink at house for special occasions or something like that. But I never really had any drinking experiences till this night. And the one thing I remembered was just being afraid. I was just afraid. And I thought everybody was afraid. I really didn't know it was any different than that. And I thought being afraid was part of it. I thought after I died, they'd do an autopsy. They'd find a bowling ball in my stomach or something. Because I always felt like one was there. And I just sort of accepted it. And I accepted being afraid. I accepted being little. I accepted being confused. I accepted not understanding anything. I just sort of accepted. I thought that's the way life was. And this day, I joined the Marine Corps in 1961. And off I go with three guys who I'd never met prior to that time. And we went off to a bar in Pittsburgh. Now, I don't know if you've ever been in a bar in Pittsburgh, but let me tell you about it. This place was filled with real men. You know, I mean, real men. I mean, you know, not phonies like me, but real men. You know, they had tattoos, they spit on the floor. I'm telling you, they knew words and things I couldn't even imagine doing, you know. And every one of them had a real woman with them, you know. And a real woman's a woman who hangs around with real men. And guys like me get what's left. And I remember I go into this bar with these three guys, and we sat down, and a bartender came over. He's a real man, too, and he came over, and he said, "What do you want?" And I thought that was a real good question, and I hadn't the slightest idea how to answer that question, so I watched the other guys, and they all ordered a beer, so I did, too. And then we drank it, nothing great. And then they ordered another one, so I did, too. Okay. Ordered a third one, so did I. And then it happened. It's amazing, absolutely amazing. I remember I stood up. I don't even think about standing up. I don't think I wanted to stand up. I just stood up. And there it was. The floor was 6 feet, 4 inches below me. You know? And I looked out. My right shoulder was out to here, and my left shoulder was out to there. And the muscles were rippling through my body. It's unbelievable. Amazing. I never forget as long as I live. But the amazing thing was what happened in my mind. It was clear. There was no fear. There was no confusion. There was no nothing. The Marine Corps, you know, just a few minutes before, I was afraid about being in the Marine Corps because I heard they took people down to South Carolina and drowned them. You know? And then all of a sudden, I knew all about the Marine Corps. I just knew all about it. And then I looked up, and my heart broke. I mean, you know, up until this time, 17 years, I'd spent so much time thinking about myself that I didn't know what the world was like. And I looked around that room, and I wanted to cry. This room was filled with pathetic little men, you know? And they all had a woman with them who was looking at me with hungry eyes. You know how they do, you know? And they were saying things like, "God, if I could have a man like that," you know? And I remember what happened to me. I transformed. I became another human being. I became completely concerned with the people around me. And I'd never been like that before. I went from table to table, filling them in. They had thousands of questions. They want to know about growing up. They want to know what it was like to be a real man. They want to know about sex. They want to know about politics. And I went from table to table. And it seemed like the more I told them, the more confused they became. And I kept telling them more and more and more. And I remember the time came when I had to leave. And I somehow imagined there would be a little plaque in a bar up in Pittsburgh that says, "Keith Lewis stopped here." I just felt that would be the way it was, you know. And I got these guys down to the train, these cretins I was with, got them on a train, and it went into the Pullman coach. And I don't know exactly what happened. It must not have been good because I woke up on the floor of the Pullman coach the next morning and someone had wet the floor I was laying on. And the man was banging on the door and told me I had to get off the train. And I got off the train. It was terrible. I was little and scared again. And I don't know what had happened to me, but the guys with me said, "We're going to go over and have a couple of drinks. You want to come?" I said, "Yeah." And the same thing happened again. And I realized that my problem was I was sober. I've been sober for 17 years. And that was my problem. Because I was ill-equipped to live in the world the way it was. I just had absolutely no tools to live in the world. So I must tell you that if I were not alcoholic, I'd be a dead man by now. And I really know that. I'd be dead or I'd be in a wraparound sport coat or something. Because I was not equipped to live in the world the way it is. I just wasn't. I had absolutely no tools, none whatsoever. I loved the Marine Corps. I really did. I spent 4 years there, and I just was crazy about it. After the nuns, it was kind of easy, you know. And I got a lot of nice things. I got a Dress Blues Award off of Paris Island, and I got a lot of meritorious promotions. I just loved it. I really did. It's kind of nice being short if you're in the Marine Corps, because all these tall guys, you know, drone instructors, they always get these guys that on the posters, you know, and they make them drill instructors. They think little people can't do anything, you know. So all you do is act like it was hurting, and do it anyway. And they say, isn't that wonderful? Look at that guy. You know. So they give you all this stuff. And but I loved it, man. I really did. I loved running around the world and this and that. And I wanted to stay. And I worked very hard to get a commission. And I got an opportunity to go to Quantico, to Officers Candidate School. And I turned it down. And I had all these reasons for why I turned it down. It was because of this and that and the Marine Corps, too political. And I had all these reasons. You know, the reason was I was alcoholic. That's the reason. The reason was it was beginning to catch up with me. And the only defense I had was to move on. I had ended up almost getting myself and a couple people killed. Just a lot of near misses. And I knew that the only way was to move on. So I moved on. And you know, my disease is no different than most anybody else's. I went from place to place, and I ended up doing a lot of crazy things, and I ended up getting married and had two beautiful daughters one of which is going to be a sophomore at Auburn, and the other is going to be a junior at Duquesne University in Pittsburgh, and you know, just wonderful gifts, but my alcoholism just went on, and you know, I ended up being thrown out by my wife, and I ended up living in a dive in Washington, D.C. It was on Harvard Street by the zoo, which really fit. And I still had a job that I just wasn't good about showing up. When I was there, I was brilliant, absolutely brilliant, but I couldn't always get there because I'd be thinking, you know? I mean, they paid me to think. And I'd be thinking, and didn't always get there. I used to think at different places. I remember, I used to think, and there was a bootleg joint on 14th Street I used to think in. And I was the only white guy there. And I used to sit around, I'd get drunk enough, and I'd start making all these racist remarks. And one guy picked me up one time, he's as big as M was, you know. And he picked me up, might have been M. Picked me up, and he shoved a .45 in my mouth, and he said, "I'd kill you, you fat mouth honky, but I don't want to do you no favors." And he threw me out of this bootleg joint. Now, I don't know if you've ever been thrown out of a bootleg joint, but let me tell you, it's bad. They're always in the basement, and if you think getting thrown down steps is bad, you know, what they do is they throw you, and you go about two steps, and you stop abruptly, you know. And then they grab you, and they throw you again, and you go about two steps, and they stop abruptly, you know. And boy, I tell you, you talk about gratitude. A sidewalk is gratitude when you're getting thrown out of a bootleg joint. And so I never went back. I mean, I wasn't born yesterday. So I began to drink in a zoo. I don't know if we have any zoo drinkers here, but I hope nobody drinks again, but if there are any Al-Anoners here who want to qualify, I'd like to recommend a zoo. It's sort of nice. They've ruined the National Zoo. Used to be a lot nicer than it is now. The week after the end of our honeymoon, they didn't over, I know. Saturday, the week after we were married, we were in Washington, D.C., and we went by the zoo, and it's not the same. They made this new thing for the animals. The way it was before is for the drinkers, because they had just cages, and they had these bleachers. And I used to get a Tupperware glass. I used to fill this Tupperware, 20-ounce glass up, with whatever I had, and I'd put an ice cube in it so I wouldn't be an alcoholic. And then I'd put the lid on it, and I'd burp, and I know about Tupperware. And I'd walk down the street to the zoo, and I'd go in, and I'd sit up on the bleachers directly across from this one cage, and in that cage was an orangutan. You know, after you go to a place for a while, you get to know everybody. And I'd sit there across from, and I'd walk in, and the orangutan would be glad to see me, you know, and jump up and down and jump up and down. And you got to know that there weren't a lot of people glad to see me at this time, and I was kind of glad to see the orangutan, and we'd laugh and you know and everything. And you know what we used to do? I'd sit out in the bleachers and the orangutan would be over in a cage. And we used to laugh at the people who came in and out of there, you know? And this orangutan, I'm telling you, it's great, completely uninhibited. You know what I mean? Just the way I always wanted to be. And I remember one time, I love this, and there's not a real alcoholic in here who won't like this. So this is a test. Okay? So take out a blank sheet of paper and put your name up in the left-hand corner. No, I'm just kidding. This orangutan reached down. There was a family there. You know, family, you know, mother, father, little kids, you know, the conventional way. And this orangutan reached down and picked up droppings and threw it at him. And I began to cheer. I thought that's just the greatest thing in the world. And look at you. See, the Al-Anons are the ones that are going... And throw it at him, you know. And somebody asked me if it was a male or a female. You know, it's hard to tell with an orangutan. But, you know, it didn't matter because I was impotent by then. So, you know, one day I went down and the orangutan looked at me in what I perceived to be utter disgust and... walked away to the back of the cage, and I knew it was going to happen. It's just a matter of time, and I began to curse the orangutan, and they threw me out of there, and I told them, I said, I won't be back, you know, and until last month I wasn't. So I kind of considered that the end of my social drinking, because then I went home and. I went home and drank by myself, and then I began to drink like no one I knew ever drank. I began to drink day and night, and I'd always prided myself on things like I had never missed work and on and on and on, and I never drank in the morning and all that business, which wasn't true. I drank the first morning, but it was no longer any. You know, all the stops were out, and that one day I realized that I just couldn't live anymore. And I went into the bathroom, and I was living in this dive. You should have seen it. It was underground. You know, it was the basement of this house. So dark, even mold wouldn't grow down there. And I had this medicine cabinet that was filled with pills. I worked in the hospitals, and my ex-wife had been a nurse, and everybody noticed my nervous condition, and they were always giving me these pills, and I was afraid of them. I just never took them. I said that one time in a meeting, and a little girl came up to me after the meeting and said, "That's the saddest story I ever heard." You know? But I just never took the things, and I just decided I couldn't live anymore. And I know a lot of you have had that experience, and I just knew that I just couldn't go on like this, And I got all the pills ready, and to this day, I can't remember if I began to take them or not. I really don't know. But what I do remember was a clear thought. And, you know, when your mind's fogged for a long time, I didn't know that it wasn't clear. It wasn't until I had this clear thought that I knew how fogged I'd been. And I remember saying, "Well, you're 29, and at least we'll be over." And I remember thinking... You know, when you're 29, it's not supposed to just be over. It's supposed to be starting. And that wasn't my thought. And I remembered also that this woman that I had tormented for so long had given me two phone numbers when I left. And she said, "If you ever want to do anything for yourself, call these numbers. Maybe they can help you." And I had lost one. And it turned out that the one I lost was to Alcoholics Anonymous. The second one was to a treatment center. And I called, and this woman with a British accent answered the phone. And it's, you know, silly things when you're a drowning man and something happens. But I remember feeling such confidence in her because she had a British accent. I don't understand why. I don't know why. But it just meant so much to me. And I just said to her, "If you don't take me, I'm going to die." And she said, "What's the problem?" And I said, "I don't know. I think I'm crazy. But I'm drinking around the clock. And if you don't take me, I'm going to die." And she said, "Can you not drink between now and Wednesday?" This was Monday. And I said, "Yeah, I think." And she said, "Come out here Wednesday. You know where we are." No, she said, "Give me your phone number. I'll call you back." So I gave her my number. And I sat down. And I never forget this. I looked up and it was a fifth of scotch on a draining board in this little kitchen. And if you're new, this is just my thought on this, and, you know, ask your sponsor. They'll probably tell me I'm wrong, especially if you're an old-timer. And but this is my thought, that God has given you something special for this journey, that everybody who comes in here has something very, very special. And I'll tell you what my special gift was. I looked at that bottle, and I knew that if I took one more drink, I was going to die. But knowing that would never keep me from taking it. I, for a long time, had tried to scare myself into being good. I'd hear that they were doing an autopsy on a chronic alcoholic in the morgue, and I'd go down there and scrub in and watch. And they'd take that liver out, you know, it looked like a lump of coal, and a brain about, two-thirds of normal size, and I'd look at all that, and I'd go, yuck! And I'd run down to Chadwick's, and I'd say, Vinny, you better give me a double. You'll never guess what I just saw. And Vinny would say, you always get a double. I said, well, you better make it a triple. So he'd give me a triple martini, and I'd sit there, and a guy sitting on either side of me would say, what's the matter? I'd say, it's the most horrible thing I ever saw. I said, I just saw an autopsy on an alcoholic, and you'll never guess. Oh, it's awful. And I began describing the liver and the brain, and they said, that's terrible. Vinny, you better give us a triple. And we'd sit there, and we'd ask questions like, what's the matter with some people? You know? Don't they have any pride? And all these, no self-respect. And so I knew that I couldn't be scared sober. I knew that. And I knew that if I took one more drink, I'd die, and knowing that would never, ever keep me from taking it. That knowledge would avail me nothing. And I ran over, and I grabbed that bottle, and I began to dump it out. And I knew I wouldn't. I knew I was powerless. And I'll tell you how I see it. If there's one bottle of booze left in the world, I'll find it, and I'll drink it. I got a disease that says that. And I took that bottle, and I threw it in the sink, and it broke. And I think if it had bounced, I wouldn't be here, because I am utterly powerless. And they called back, and they said they could take me Wednesday. And I went through the horror. And a lot of people know what that's like. I saw things, and I heard things. And I had to get some money to get into this place. And so I had to go and get a loan and all kinds of things. And I was hearing music from strange places. And it's hard to sit in a bank trying to hold yourself together hearing Beethoven's Fifth and knowing they aren't hearing it, you know. And somehow I ended up out at that place. And that night, I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we're on a bus going to this meeting, and I said to a guy, where are we going? And he said, well, we're going to an AA meeting. And I said, what's that? And he said, well, that's a place where bunch of people get together who are alcoholics. And I said, oh, Jesus, sounds charming. And he said, yeah. And I said, where do they get together? He said, in a church basement. I said, well, that fits. You know, somehow that fits. And because they wouldn't let them upstairs. And we arrived at this meeting, and the strangest thing happened. There was a man standing at the door. And, you know, a really obnoxious kind of guy, you know, who looked you in the eye. You know the kind? You know, pushy kind. You know, the bars I hung out in, he'd get his lights punched out for that. But he'd stand there, and he'd smile, and he'd look you in the eye, you know, and he'd shake your hand, you know. And it's like he had two heads. Wherever I looked, his face was there, and he's looking deep in my eyes. And he said to me, you know, Sonny, if you keep coming back here, you never have to drink again. And I went in, and I sat down, and this old woman came over and sat next to me and brought me a half a cup of coffee. She's a pervert. She began to pat me, you know. And she's about 10 days older than dirt. And she began to pat me. And halfway through the meeting, I looked at her, trying to figure out how I can get away from her. And this old face exploded into this beautiful smile. And she said, you know, son, if you keep coming to us, you never have to be alone again. I began to cry. You know, I didn't know that what I was alone. I didn't know that's what that was. I didn't know that, you know, those nights I'd come in at 2:30 and something like that, and I'd sneak into the, I'd take my clothes off, and I'd sneak into the bedroom, and I'd slide under the covers, trying not to wake this woman up who was just going to go crazy and scream and carry on. And I'd lay there perfectly still, and she'd lay there perfectly still. still. And we lay like that all night. And, you know, people who are asleep don't lay perfectly still. And, you know, and sometimes I'd get up when she'd be working evenings or nights, and I'd go in and I had these two beautiful little girls, Kelly and Kimberly, gorgeous little creatures. And sometimes when they were asleep, I'd pick them up and I'd hold them and I'd cry. And I'd think that nothing this nice can have anything to do with me. And I didn't know that that was alone. I didn't know that it was abnormal to feel like you sat on the sidelines watching life. I didn't know that. I thought that that's what my lot was. And I became intrigued with pushy men at the door and old broads. And I just became intrigued with what you are. And I couldn't wait to get back to the next meeting. And every time I went, there was something special about it. And then people would say things like, they'd say, "Keith, it's really good to have you here." And they'd put their arm around me, and they'd take me around and introduce me to people. They'd say, "This is our friend Keith, and he's kind of new. And we're so glad to have him here," and on and on. And it was wonderful. It was wonderful. And then they turn on you. Yeah? Yeah? You get comfortable, and they turn on you. You know? They put the old-timers on you. You know the old-timers? You know, the guys who laugh at all your problems? You know the kind? Something about them. There's something wrong with them. I don't know. Too much cigarette smoke, too much coffee, something. Something happens to their brains. And they get kind of weird. And they do awful things, just awful things. I remember this impotence problem was a problem. I mean, it wasn't a problem for a lot of people. It was a problem for me. And I thought I'd keep it a secret. And I sure wasn't going to tell my sponsor, because can you imagine sponsoring someone who's impotent? And so I never told my sponsor anything bad about me. I told him all the good stuff. So I'm looking around, and finally I made the mistake of going to an old-timer. And I'll tell you how you can tell an old-timer. I sit down, and I'm hemming and hawing and beating around the bush. And finally, he said, "What do you want?" You know, I don't know where old-timers are going, you know, but they always want you to hurry up. And finally, I just said, I said, "I'm impotent." And he went, "Ha ha ha." That's how you can tell an old-timer, you know. Yeah, they laugh at your problems. And he said, I said, "That's no problem." I said, "The hell it isn't a problem." And he said, "You're going to be all right." He said, "It'll go away." And I thought it was kind of relevant, so I said, "When?" And he said, "I don't know. What do you care? You're not allowed to do anything for a year anyway." He'd say, "Ah, a couple years." I said, "A couple of years?" And he said, "What, you got a full calendar?" So finally I got desperate enough, I went to my sponsor. And I told my sponsor what the problem was, and he just smiled. He hadn't been around a long time. And he said to me, "It'll go away." I said, "When?" Yeah. He was an interesting guy. He said, "Well," he said, "that's hard to say." He said, "But," he said, "you have a lot of problems, don't you?" I said, "I got a lot of problems." He said, "Every time we go to a meeting and they bring up a problem, you've got it." I said, "That's the damnedest thing, you know. Every time they bring up a problem, I've got it." He said, "So," he said, "the truth is that you got a lot of problems." He said, "Maybe thousands." I said, "Tens of thousands." He said, "Tens of thousands." He said, "This is just one, huh?" And I said, "Well, yeah. And he said, "Tell me, of all those tens of thousands of problems, which one's going to be as much fun to work on as this one?" And I thought, you know, I never really looked at it that way before. And if you knew, that's what sponsors do. Sponsors put a smile on tragedy. They take the worst thing in the world and they put a smile on it and somehow make it challenging. And I remember that first year. That's a great... I had some old ideas. One or two. And one of them... was that my problem was I had a poor self-image. And I needed to be affirmed. And I needed to affirm myself. And so I went to an old... You hear a little bit of... Every once in a while you hear something like that. And I went off again, like a fool, to an old-timer. And I was talking to him about some problems. And he said, tell you what I want you to do, boy. He said, I want you to go to one of the girls. And that's how old he was. He wants you to go to one of the girls in the program, borrow a tube of lipstick. Don't do anything else for the girls in the program. And he said, oh, that's right, you can. And he'd say, I want you to borrow a tube of lipstick from one of the girls. I want you to go home and write on the mirror, Keith, you are wrong. I said, I can't do that. I said, you don't seem to understand. My problem is I have a poor self-image. I got to affirm myself. I mean, I can't be wrong. I think too little of myself now. He said, borrow some lipstick. I said, okay. So I wasn't going to owe anybody anything, especially a woman. So I went and bought a tube of lipstick. I went home. I wrote on the mirror, Keith, you are wrong. And I threw the rest of the lipstick in the trash, and I said, these people are crazy. And I went off to sleep, right? And I woke up the next morning. It was like every other morning. You know, the first thing I thought was, you're never going to make it. Today, you're going to go to work, and they're going to find out you don't know how to do the job you've been doing for 7 years. You're never, ever going to have sex again, but it doesn't matter because nobody would want to have it with you anyway. You know? You're never going to stay sober. One day, those people in AA are going to find out what you're really like, and they're not going to let you come back. You know, normal, usual morning, you know. And when I made some coffee, and I thought about killing myself, and I was crying, and just the usual stuff. And I went in, and I looked at the mirror, and it said, Keith, you are wrong. I said, thank God. If I'm right, I'm in a hell of a lot of trouble. So then I had another old idea, only two that year. I had another old idea. And the other old idea was that for every problem, there's only one answer. And the way it works is this. If you know this is how it works. Once you discover the problem, a clock starts. Okay? And if you don't get the answer, okay, before the alarm goes off, a big hand comes down and pours a drink down your throat. Okay? That's the way it works. And I discovered this problem. And there were a couple guys who I'd go to with problems. And they always had the answer. And I'd run to them. I'd give them the problem. They'd give me the answer. I'd go, thank God. Now I don't have to drink. And I went out. I can't remember. I belonged to the Problem of the Month Club. A group of us hung around together. And I had this problem. I can't remember it now, but it was a biggie then. And I realized it. And it hit me. Like I said, my God. And the clock started. And I ran out to see Don. And Don, you know what he did? He looked at me. He said, I don't know the answer to that. I said, oh, no. And he said, but there's a man downtown Washington who knows the answer to that. He's in the Metropolis Club. So he told me where it was. I got in the car. I drove downtown. I went in. I got like an hour and 10 minutes to live. And I asked for this guy. And they said he's on a 12-step call. I said, what's he doing on a 12-step call? I said, this is an emergency. He said, he'll be back in a few minutes for the meeting. So I sat down, and then he came, dragging his drunk with him. And I ran over. I said, I got to talk to you. He said, wait till after the meeting. I said, this is important. He said, it'll hold for an hour. And so the meeting was over, and we went over, and he sat down, and he said, now, what's the problem, boy? And I told him this problem. And I never forget this man as long as I live. He was sober a long, long time. He was a black man, and a beautiful, beautiful face, kind, kind man. And I told him this problem, and I waited. And he looked at me, and he said, boy, he said, I don't know the answer to that. And I said, oh, no, you know. And I just felt like crying. And he said, but, I'll give you some advice. And I said, what's that? He said, don't drink even if your ass falls off. I remember driving home thinking, that's the most profound thing. And I discovered that being sober isn't about finding answers. It isn't about finding answers. You know, I got more answers than there are questions. I mean, that's what it is to be an alcoholic. I got answers for questions haven't even been asked yet. You ever see somebody say, does anybody know? And if there are 10 alcoholics in a room, 10 alcoholics lean, you know, to give an answer, okay? 10 Al-Anons get ready to correct them, you know? So, it's not about having answers. Alcoholics Anonymous is about solutions. It's about solutions. And I got to tell you, the greatest news in my life is that I'm wrong. I've been wrong about everything. And that's a great news. I'm telling you, it's really great. It's wonderful. You know, I was wrong about God. Thank goodness I was wrong about God. I was wrong. And I discovered that God wasn't after me. He wanted me, but he wasn't after me. And there's a difference. You know, I was wrong about nuns. I was wrong about religious people. Remember religious people? Ergo, hypocrites. Remember that? Yeah.
I don't like organized religion. I used to say it all the time. Well, I don't like organized religion. I realized one day, it's not that I didn't like organized religion. The problem was I wasn't a pope. If
I'd have been a pope, I'd have loved organized religion. You know? That's a problem. You know, and, you know, Bill W. says, be quick to see where religious people are. Let me tell you what I did about this business with religious people. You know, I had them on a 9-step list. Religious people, I don't know, religious people. And I did. I had put God on there, too. And I put on his 3-piece suit, and I went off to his chapel. I want to look good, you know. I went in, and I talked to God about, you know, that I owed him an amends. And I was really sorry, you know, for the blasphemous things and this and that and all that stuff. And on. And I left there. And I've been afraid since then, but I've never been in terror from that day on. And shortly after that, I went down to this retreat center in Faulkner, Maryland. And one of the blessings of my recovery was I was given a scholarship, and I got a degree out of Georgetown University. And while I was there, I had a theology professor who was sort of a young, hep guy. And I was going to go down and make amends to him for these religious people, because he would know the magnificence of this humble act I was performing. And you know, I could never find him. He's never in his room. But next to his room was a room with an old guy who's just sitting in his rocking chair with a blanket over his lap reading his Bible. He's rocking in a rocking chair. And it suddenly occurred to me that maybe I was supposed to talk to this man. His name was Jim, Father Jim. And I said, may I have a moment? He said, of course, son, come in. And he set me down in a rocking chair across from him. And I began to tell him why I was there. I began to tell him about how I had ridiculed spiritual people who tried to do the right thing. And how I had found fault with them, and how I'd find one of them that made a mistake, and I'd paint them all with the same brush. And I was telling him about this, and I began to tell him about my alcoholism, and I began to tell him how I abused the woman I was married to, how I left a 4-month-old child in a crib because I needed to get a drink, how my second daughter was born with hyaline membrane disease, and I was so drunk I almost didn't get her mother to the hospital, and how I couldn't support her mother, who was just like a zombie, as we thought this child was going to die, because I was too isolated and alone and too sick. And I went on and on. And this saintly man put his Bible down, and he got up, and he put his arms around me, and he began to pat me, and he began to cry. He said, please, he said, I've been a priest for 50 years. And he said, I'm dying of cancer. And he said, I've been praying about what it is that's unfinished in my life. And he said, I realize that it's not you who owe me an amends. It's I who owe you an amends. He said, all too often in these 50 years, I forgot what my higher power told me, and that was to leave the 99 I was comfortable with and to go find the one that was lost. And he said, I'm sorry you had to be out there all alone. And I came to realize what these steps are about. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a selfish program. It's not. I'm convinced it's not. Alcoholics Anonymous and the steps can heal the world. There's a man who is a spiritual giant who needed me. Can you imagine that? He needed this angry, sick kid to come by and to fill in a little piece of his life so he could complete it and go on. What a privilege to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I got sober in the Washington, D.C. area, and in 1980 I left there, and I went down to Fayetteville. And as I was sitting, I was sober about 7 or 8 years in, and I was sitting on a balcony overlooking this little lake, and I was reading a big book, and I was just meditating on the beauty and the love that God represents to me, and in the gratitude I had, and I began to cry, and I said, you know, why me, Father? Why did you pick me for this? And I remembered that day I went out to that treatment center, and it was about 2 days later, I guess, and I called my ex-wife, and she said, hello, and I said, it's me, and she said, what do you want? And I said, I'm an alcoholic. And she said, no shit. I said, but why me? And she said, why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do. And she hung up the phone. You know? And I was sitting there, and I was saying to God, you know, why me? Why me? And he said, why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do. And that's what I know. Not because I'm me, but because he's him. That's why I deserve it. And you know, I got to tell you, everything that I've been wrong about has been a blessing in my life. About 4 years ago, I had moved from Alabama back to Fayetteville. And I was had just gotten out of relationship number 33 or whatever it was, you know. And I'd always tried to make things work. I tell you, I always tried to make things work. And when it wouldn't work, I would make it work. And when I try to make things work, I can be careless and brutal. And I had 33 amends to make. And I remember it was July the 5th, 1985. And it was the night of July the 4th. And I was at my friend's house, somebody who got sober in a Biscayne room, a man named Bob B., who's a dear friend of mine. And I was just agonizing over the fact that I just couldn't. I'd done the steps, I'd done everything I knew how to do, and I couldn't have a decent relationship. And I got out of bed, it was about midnight, and I got out of bed and I got on my knees and I said, Father, I'm going to stay here till it's all right. I'm just going to stay here till it's all right. I said, I'm lonely, and I've been lonely all my life. And I began to pray. And my friend Dick came in, and Dick was about 5 minutes late, so he had to sleep on his sofa. We always gather at Bob's house when we're out of coming into town. And I got up the next morning, and I prayed all night. And I got up the next morning, and I went out and I said to Dick, I said, I want you to be my witness. I said, I just told God that I am not going to abuse myself or women anymore. I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to ask him for anything. I'm going to work with drunks, and I'm going to seek God's will in my life. And if he wants me to have someone in my life, I will. And if he doesn't, I won't. But I'm no longer going to be the slob I've been. I'm not going to do it anymore. And he said, I heard you. And he said, I've been praying too. And I meant it. And I do mean it. And I went off to a meeting that night that I didn't want to go to. My friend Bob was speaking, and I didn't want to go to this particular meeting. And that night, I met a woman, and we said hi, and exchanged cards, and I went back to Alabama. I couldn't get her out of my mind. There was something about her that was gentle and pretty and pure. Something that touched me in places that I had always guarded before, in places I'd never ever let anybody. And it's my wife, Julie. And I came back, and I went to my sponsor, Tom I, and I said, Tom, I don't want to ruin this. Please help me. And Tom has helped me every step of the way. And I must tell you, every instinct I had was wrong. Every one. When I first met her, I'd been asked to speak at the Jekyll Island retreat. And a long time ago, I was taught that when I come here, I'm your guest, and I am going to be a good guest. And that doesn't mean I drag somebody along with me that I'm not married to. But do you know, Julie and I talked for 20 minutes, and we figured out a way that would make this different. And I went and talked to Tom, and Tom's such a wonderful man, and he said, well, yeah, those are all real good reasons. He said, now tell me, when you stand up to share, will it affect you? And of course it would, because I'd be doing something wrong. So we didn't do that. We were going to live together. Tom says, "My goodness, Keith, you have a beautiful relationship. You two love one another. Why do you have to do it that way? Why not do it right?" And I said to him, I said, "You know, engagement's a thing of the past. I mean, you know, that's the way it used to be, an engagement period. That's crazy." He said, "Keith, do it. Do it because it's right." So I bought Julie a ring and gave it to her one Christmas Eve before we went off to midnight mass together. And she just fell into my arms. And I knew why I was supposed to be engaged, because engaged was different than dating. And then we were engaged for over a year and a half. And then we became married. Being married is different than being engaged. And you know, I never ever would have done it that way, because my instinct isn't to do it the right way. I haven't had a drink in 16 years and 2 months today. And tomorrow, my instincts won't be right. Not for me. All the guys I sponsor, I'm great. I mean, I can see them as clearly as Tom can see me. But when it comes to me, I'm blind. And that's why I need you. You know, I've got a disease called alcoholism, and this is the way it works. The drink, there's a very important drink in my life, and that was May the 13th, 1973. That was my last one to this day. Okay, but there's a drink that's more important to me, and that's the drink that's out ahead of me that I'll take. I have a disease that says I'll take this drink. Not I might, or if I'm not lucky. It says you'll take it unless there's a miracle. And so each day that I'm with you, each day I go to a meeting, I can push that drink further out ahead of me. And I tell you my goal. My goal is to live to be 101. When I'm 100, I'm going to really clean it up, and I'm going to spend one good year in case they were right about purgatory and stuff. You know? And then 6 months later, after I died, somebody's going to say, "Hey, whose martini is that?" And they'll say, "Well, that's Keith, but he died." See? So my goal is to push it ahead of me one day at a time until I die. And, you know, I've seen people, and I talked to a man day before yesterday who didn't push it ahead of him. He stopped going to meetings after 6 years. You know, it took him 2 years to catch up to that drink. But one day it was there, and he took it. And he said, "I don't know what happened to it. I don't know what happened to me. I know I can't drink safely." I said, "You didn't go to where you learned to push it ahead of you one day at a time." And that's what I have to thank you for. And that's why I need you, and I need you more now than I've ever needed you in my life. Such a privilege to be here with you. I'm looking forward to this weekend. And, you know, when the official conference starts tomorrow, I'm going to be absolutely delighted. So if your sponsor is making you keep track of meetings, don't count this one. I love you very much. Thank you.